Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, this is the second part of our two-segment crossover between the Agora Show's Wittenberg to Westphalia and Tiny Vampires.
If you haven't listened to the first segment of Wittenberg to Vampires, we suggest that you check that out first. Let's start where we left off, shall we?
Let's come back to the subject of refuse, which I mentioned before. There's sort of two kinds of refuse that you need to worry about when you're talking about a large number of people living together. In an era before industrial packaging, you're talking about sort of general trash, but let's put a pin in that one. And the other one we want to talk about is human waste. Interesting story. My wife and I, our first anniversary when we started dating, we went to a waste treatment plant in Atlantic City.
Romantic.
Yeah. I'm great. They have it's a cool wind generation thing that's co-located with the waste treatment plant, and they use it to power the plant. But...
Oh, see, I find that stuff super interesting. Like anything tangentially related to public health is just completely fascinating to me. Yeah, so
I expected to learn a lot about the windmills, but yeah, the sewage treatment plant ended up being really interesting, and for both me and I as well. So it was fun.
Yeah, it's that sort of thing that makes you know who you're really meant to be with. If you're both like, oh,
yeah,
then yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
So people in the Middle Ages, again, knew that human waste was gross to have around and it smelled bad, so it probably wasn't good for you, and you didn't want it around when you were trying to eat. So they would ideally, they knew that digging latrines in camps was a good idea. And then people could do their business and not have it impact the water supply or the food. Yeah, they probably didn't wash their hands, but in the world before germ theory, you sort of take what you get. Interestingly, they did wash their hands before they ate. It was just, so they didn't, and it was sort of backwards from the way we do it now, but that's whatever, it's fine. So the thing, though, with latrines is it's kind of hard, and it's not all that glamorous. So it was usually delegated to servants and slaves. But I've read at least one source who noted that if there were no servants or slaves available, the latrines were simply not dug. Personally, I think it's fairly iffy that latrine digging would be high on the to-do list anyway. And when you're talking about an army on the march, maybe they don't have time. So then if the latrines aren't dug, what do people do? Well, they just sort of sneak off into the bushes and do their thing out of sight. Convenient bodies of water were also very favored, in an era before germ theory. If you think about it, if you put waste into a large enough water body, it no longer seems like a problem if you don't know better. It doesn't smell anymore, at least for the first few patrons. And anyway, it all gets, you know, washed away. So what ends up happening is that people use the river, and many sources talk about, you know, passing armies seriously fouling rivers in their path, especially if they have to cross the river. So then you have people marching into the water and stirring up all the sediment and then doing their business and, you know, probably also dumping trash, general trash into the water. So all downstream, it's very unpleasant.
Yeah, not to mention the animals also walking through there. And yeah.
Yes. So given that the river was likely to be the only source of water for the army, Raven, what can you tell me about dysentery?
Yeah, logical progression, right? So anyone around our age who played Oregon Trail has heard of dysentery. it's actually not one disease. It actually describes a condition of having bloody diarrhea.
Yeah.
So it can be caused by a virus, bacteria, parasitic infections. So it's more of something that's doing damage to the intestines and causing this condition than it is like one single disease. So most common are bacterial and amoeboid. So in our day and age, it usually isn't fatal, but for these soldiers, they were already suffering from conditions like malnutrition, like we already talked about, and many of them were sleeping on the ground. Their immune systems would have been in no position to fight off this assault and repair the internal damage that was being done by these pathogens. And as for the pathogen itself, it's, you know, like I said, it's either a bacteria or an amoeba. What it was actually doing is infecting the walls of the intestine. So to try to get rid of it, the body attempts to dislodge them by flushing water from the body into the intestines and then out of the body. So that's where this diarrhea comes from. And the blood is coming from the damage that's being done to the intestinal walls.
Right.
So it results in severe dehydration. You can think like all that water is moving out of the body. So,
yeah.
You know, severe dehydration, of course, and delirium and a coma and then death. So a person that comes in contact with water or food supply that is contaminated, you can kind of imagine a cook. He doesn't wash his hands after using the bathroom. He already has this condition, and it can spread pretty quickly through the camp because all of these different people are eating this food, right?
Yeah.
And so after eating this contaminated food, a soldier, camp follower, whoever, would start showing symptoms anywhere from 2 to 10 days later. And then in really severe cases would actually be dead within 24 hours. It's just, you know, like a sponge. It just sucks all the water out of your body. So it's really hard to recover from.
Which then, you know, I can imagine it makes things, it creates this vicious cycle where people are, you know, trying to get more water and then contaminating the water with their illness as they try and rehydrate themselves.
Right, exactly. And then they're also intaking contaminated water that's actually not going to help them at all. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So even if they didn't die, the dysentery would have done so much damage to their intestines, it would make it harder for them to absorb nutrients from their food. So if they didn't have scurvy before, then there's a lot more chance that they would get it now because their intestines just couldn't absorb any of, like, the little vitamin C that they were already getting.
So our story for this illness, man, that's awful.
Yeah.
Dysentery seems horrible.
It's a nightmare.
It's so common. It's my sources say that dysentery is probably the second most common after, like, the nutritional diseases. And there's just so many, leaders who end up dying of it, which we're going to see in a second. But it's just, you know, you think of these leaders and they're so dignified in the way that they present themselves. And then dysentery happens.
Yeah, it's kind of an equalizer, isn't it?
Yeah. So our story for this illness is fairly similar to the one for scurvy, and they seem to be pretty linked in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
In 1270, the King of France, who's now known as Saint Louis, turned the full force of his kingdom towards a crusade. He was actually fairly mad for crusading. He would try and go on several in his lifetime, and actually he grew up during the Albigensian Crusade, which is a whole nother horror show. But as we discussed earlier, everyone was starting to suspect that just plowing your army into the Levant without any logistical support was a bad plan. And so the Fifth Crusade had sought to take Egypt, but that didn't go well. So in the Eighth Crusade, King Louis decided to follow the inevitable logic already in place and attack slightly further to the west. In this case, he attacked Tunis, which is in northern Africa. He apparently thought that it was an important source of troops and food for Egypt, which it wasn't, and that the Sultan would convert to Christianity, which he didn't. So none of this was true, but apparently he thought this because his brother, Charles of Anjou, told him so. Charles is a fascinatingly horrible character, a real slippery snake, who ruled in Sicily and southern Italy, which we're going to be talking about him a lot more later in my show.
Yeah, don't trust your siblings, folks.
Yes, definitely. Although Louis had actually nominated him for getting that land in Sicily and Italy. But I'm going to get to that in, you know, a few hundred episodes. He was sort of building up this little Mediterranean empire. And so he was interested in ruling Tunisia as well. He figured if his brother took over Tunisia, then, you know, his brother would march off to try and take Egypt. And, you know, Charles could rule in his stead. There's some debate about this as the motivation, but that's the most common story, and it makes the best narrative. So when the troops landed in Tunisia, the story was very similar to the story in Diomede, only more so. The army was stuck basically on the beach, but now it was in a desert region and not just in a swamp. They were attempting to besiege a city with no support and with the surrounding countryside activated against them. They had a limited number of water sources, and dysentery broke out pretty quickly and ravaged the army.
Yeah, dysentery is especially a problem in these situations with little fresh water, because people are forced to drink from sources that they would otherwise avoid, right?
Right, yeah. I always think about that when I'm watching, like, Lawrence of Arabia. There's the scene where he drinks water out of the well, and, like, you see a little bit of the water, and I always see it and go, oh, man.
Yeah. Like, that's not clear at all.
No, that's not clean.
Yeah.
Anyway, so King Louis eventually also got sick and died, just like so many of his soldiers. But he only did so after his eldest son died, which left the throne of France in the hands of the ironically named Philip the Bold, who was an indecisive and timid man fond of soft living. So not super bold.
I can identify with that.
He would incidentally die himself in 1285, also of dysentery, which he caught on campaign in a war caused, again, by his uncle, Charles of Anjou. But that is a story for later.
Yeah, not having enough water around is a problem, obviously, for obvious reasons, but too much can also be a problem. Pools of water and these swampy areas are favored breeding sites for mosquitoes, which brings us to malaria.
Excellent.
Yeah, malaria kills thousands of people to this day. It is like even those that don't die can become seriously ill.
Right.
It's a tiny parasite that's transmitted by mosquitoes. So after an infected mosquito bites a person, the parasite travels to their liver, where it multiplies. And then over time, they leave the liver, and they're so tiny, they actually move into the victim's red blood cells. Hmm. So inside the red blood cell, they have a very cozy home, and they're not attacked by the immune system. So they just multiply and multiply until the red blood cell can't hold them anymore and the cell pops. And so they disperse and infect other red blood cells, and this kind of is a cascading situation.
Yeah.
So this damage to the blood and the liver causes serious anemia, and for some people it leads to death.
Right.
And particularly affects people, you know, in the situations that we're talking about, it affects people with less than perfect immune systems.
Sure.
But it's also a huge problem. Like, nowadays, it's a huge problem for small children and the elderly.
So you say that it's a parasite. And I've read that a bunch of times before, and it always I was always a little bit curious about that. But, like, how is it different from a bacteria or a virus if it's small enough that it's presumably operating on the cellular level that it's attacking red blood cells? Is it a multicell organism or something? Or how is it being a parasite different from it being a bacteria or whatever?
Yeah. So that's a great question. Okay. So the difference is that these parasites are animals. So if you think about a bacteria, it doesn't have a nucleus. So this is getting way back to biology.
Okay.
A bacteria, it doesn't have any organelles.
Right.
So it's a different branch of life, basically.
Okay, cool.
So these parasites are more closely related to, say, plants in that they have, different organelles. They have, like, mitochondria and, a nucleus and all of that. So that's what makes it a parasite, whereas, say, a virus, depending on who you ask, they're not even alive.
Right,
they're just packages of protein and DNA or RNA.
Right.
And then you have funguses. So, like, a parasite is more like a fungus than it is like a bacteria.
Okay, cool. Cool, thank you. That's...
Yeah.
All right, so that brings us to our example, which is something we covered in my show quickly, and we're going to cover it again quickly. But basically, the Romans in the Roman Empire had done an awful lot to control nature, though exactly how much is open for debate. They never really controlled the rivers of Italy, but they made some attempts to do so. They drained some swamps, they did some channelization. But more importantly, they created roads and transportation systems that allowed swamps to be avoided. Much of this fell apart during the Italian Wars at the end of the Roman Empire, and equally important settlement patterns shifted. Villages, towns, and even cities just sort of up and moved because of the political instability, and there's armies marching here and there, and lords attacking everybody, and so that they would up and move from these sort of fertile but upland areas in the plains into places where it would be harder to attack them. Many moved up into the hills and the mountains, but a few cities went the other way. And this was very important in the Po Valley in northern Italy. Most famously, Venice is a city founded at the mouth of the Po River by refugees of various periods of invasions in different places in northern Italy. Now, these refugees were seeking a way to get away from everything that's going on mainland Italy, and so they built on islands, which are really not much more than sandbars at the mouth of this river. They were technically, as we get into the Middle Ages, a possession of the Eastern Roman Empire. But they were very far from Constantinople, and they had a lot of independence. When Charlemagne conquered Italy, a dispute broke out over their ownership. They had, back when the Byzantines had conquered Italy under Justinian II, they weren't really that important, but they'd been built up over that time. So now it was something to talk about. As disputes started to break out between Charlemagne and the Eastern Roman Empire, with Charlemagne famously claiming to be the Holy Roman Emperor, which made the people who considered themselves the emperors of Rome in the East somewhat cranky, disputes broke out at the points of contact, which were mostly in Italy. So Charlemagne sent his son and heir apparent, Pepin, to lay siege to Venice, which was the closest and biggest, most important point of contact. Pepin did pretty well, I guess. He of course had a very big, scary army of hairy Germans, but also had something of a navy, and he managed to sort of gradually conquer islands coming from the south and from the north. But they never quite closed the door. They never quite managed to cut off sea access. They didn't have the knowledge of the sandbars and the currents and everything that, in this estuary is really tricky. And then also the Venetians, they retreated further and further into the estuary, into more and more inhospitable terrain, and started driving stakes into the marshlands so that, like, at high tide, boats wouldn't be able to get by because they'd get their bottoms caved in and stuff like that. So it ended up turning into the stalemate, where the Venetians had control of the sea and were able to go in and out because they had that local knowledge, and the Franks sort of had the mainland, and they were really closing in on the city, but they couldn't finish the deal. And so they ended up camped out on these islands in this estuary at the mouth of the Po River, just sort of looking at each other, trying to attack, in the narrowest straits between the islands. ultimately, the Venetians, the folk story is that the Venetians, during some of these attacks, would pelt the Franks with bread, which is to say that, you know, the Venetians were still getting bread. They may have lost their mainland possessions, but they had boats going out and coming back with flour and bread and stuff, and they had enough that they could just throw it at the Franks just to be like, you're not getting us.
Yeah, the little psychological warfare there.
Exactly. So we have a large army of Franks, who may or may not have been well supplied with food, camped out on sandbar islands in the middle of a lagoon full of stagnant brackish water, and then spring turned into summer. And Raven, can you take a good stab at what happened next?
Mosquitoes? Mosquitoes are what happened next?
Yes, mosquitoes are what happened. they're describing.
I raise a lot of mosquitoes, and I can tell you they would love it.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't know that any of the ancient chroniclers made the connection exactly, but they do describe, in at least one source, the mosquitoes are described as swarming. So the army sort of predictably began to succumb to malaria. We're pretty sure it's malaria.
that wouldn't be very surprising.
Yeah, it's hard to make to confirm it. But definitely diseases broke out in the summer, and they were camped in the middle of a swamp. The Franks and Venetians ultimately hammered out a deal that, if you read Frankish historians, was very good for the Franks. But this is sort of the starting point of the Venetian conception of their corporate identity. And after this, there was a lot more unity going forward. You know, the Venetians paid a little bit of a tribute to the kings of Italy, but basically they were still technically a possession of the Byzantines. And as Pippin and his army withdrew, well, Pippin died a few weeks later of whatever illness it was that was probably malaria that was going around his army. Now, Pippin was the heir apparent to Charlemagne's empire. And any of you who know much about Charlemagne's empire sort of know what happens next. The empire was left in the hands of his younger brother, who was a man who came to be known as Louis the Pious. Many chroniclers felt that he was not really up to the task. I've gone back and forth on this in my show, but the Frankish Empire ended up breaking up as a result of Louis's inability to control his own son's ambitions. Even while he was alive, his own sons were like fighting over the empire, and he's just going, wait, stop, no.
Yeah, a little ineffective control situation.
Yeah. So the malaria had a pretty big impact on the forward progress of European history there, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, it's one of those situations where if you just follow the history of malaria, you're basically following the history of, like, civilization and the halting of civilization in certain areas.
Yeah.
So it's actually an incredible story that's of course still going on today.
Yes.
And you know, we pour millions of dollars into trying to develop vaccines, medications, all of these things. You know, malaria has been with us since before we were humans.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were kind of like ancient mortal enemies.
Yeah. And, you know, within just the span of my show, like, it's an ongoing theme that these all-powerful armies from north of the Alps during the early Middle Ages, they would plow into Italy, which seemed like it was ripe for the taking. It's all these rich cities that are politically disunited, and they hate each other more than they hate the outsiders, but these armies would just come in, and after a year, they would just disappear. And, you know, it's hard to exactly tie it to malaria, but, you know, the first thing you hit after you come across the Alps is the Po Valley, which is all swampy. And
so, next we'll talk about everybody's favorite, the plague.
Of course.
So, naturally, we have to talk about the plague. Otherwise known, of course, as the Black Death. Many people know this story. The infected rats were bitten by fleas, and then the infected fleas would bite people. People spread it to other fleas and then to other people also, which is called a pneumatic plague. And so yeah, most people have heard this story before, but what a lot of people haven't heard is the story of the plague from the flea's perspective. And I think it really goes to understanding how the plague spread so fast and how kind of insidious it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So from the flea's perspective, which is like I said, key to understanding this. So the bacteria that causes the disease blocks part of the flea's throat, which is called the proventriculus. So in a healthy flea, the proventriculus acts as a temporary kind of holding tank for blood that the flea is drinking. So fleas don't have teeth, and so they don't have any way to kind of break up the blood cells that are, going into its digestive system.
Okay.
So the proventriculus is kind of covered on the inside with these kind of sharp, almost hair-like teeth that kind of slice these blood cells open as they float by and go into the flea's gut.
Okay.
So the plague bacteria blocks the connection between the proventriculus and the gut. And so once it's in there, it starts multiplying. So then the flea tries to take a blood meal from a victim, and the blood goes into the proventriculus, but it can't go into the flea's gut because it's blocked. So the flea's kind of forced to regurgitate that blood and the bacteria with it into the poor victim.
Right.
So the flea is starving, which makes it bite more and more often. Instead of just biting when the flea is hungry, it forces the flea to always be hungry because it's starving it. So it's biting constantly, moving from victim to victim, trying to get a meal that actually satisfies it.
Right, and it never will.
Right, so since it never does, then eventually the flea actually dies of starvation, which accidentally, from the flea's perspective, is actually accidentally maximizing the damage done by the plague bacteria.
Wow, yeah, that's pretty grim.
Yeah, it's interesting because for most vector-borne diseases, like malaria, is it's not doing a serious amount of damage to the mosquito. Not in the same way as this. Like the flea is dying from the plague just as much as humans are.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. So one of the things that comes out of that is for a long time it was thought that plague has to go rat, flea, human. Mm-hmm. There's been some interesting research I found recently that it was a team out of the universities of Oslo primarily, and then also Ferrara. And they did some, and they published this in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. They did some computer simulations about this, and they found that if the transmission path was only rat, flea, human, then the observed spread of the illness was not explicable because the rats and fleas would die too rapidly. Mm-hmm. So that sort of, that's really interesting because it means that once the infection started, the rats were probably no longer as important as a vector. So rat, flea, human, flea, human, flea, human, flea, human kind of thing.
Right. Well, if you think about it, the rats are also dying of the plague. So not to anthropomorphize, but if you think about it from the plague's perspective, you're killing off these rats, and that's forcing the fleas to seek out another source for blood, right? And then they're moving, into human beds, and, most of these fleas don't prefer to feed on humans. It's only when there's nothing else for them to feed on.
Right. And, of course, the fleas are dying at a pretty accelerated rate, too, because they're starving to death. So
yeah, exactly.
So one of the myths, just before we move on, about the plague. And it's got this bizarre source as a myth, but it was suggested at one point that the reason that the plague sort of stopped being such a big deal in Europe was that because the black rat was replaced by the brown rat in much of Europe, which basically is now considered, it's sort of a bizarre theory to begin with. And this whole thing with it being proved that rats weren't particularly important after a certain stage is, it sort of puts that myth to bed. So I just wanted to put that out into this episode. I'm going to get back to the plague later in my show, but just while we're on the subject.
Yeah. I mean, it's really hard to separate history from the ecology of diseases because they're so intimately connected.
Yeah. And so actually one of the points about that that's come up in the last 10, 15 years of research, these plague outbursts in Europe were linked to a cyclical population growth of like ground squirrels in Central Asia. So like sort of the Central Asian equivalent of prairie dogs and pika. And so there'd be a wet season, there'd be a lot of food, there'd be a population boom, and these animals would have the same fleas that would affect rats. And so then this wave of these animals would go out into human settlements, affect rats there, and then get carried out along trade routes. One of the interesting things in terms of the Black Death is that then what was going on in human society at that time is that that's when the Mongols were uniting essentially the Eurasian landmass by conquering this empire that went from China to Europe. What that meant, and incidentally, on the European side of this equation, the 1300s was a particularly vulnerable time. So the plague ended up arriving around 1350, and the Europe at that time had essentially, people who've been listening to my show know, Europe had had about 2 centuries to recover from the instability of the migration period, which is what I'm using. Some people call it the Dark Ages, but I don't think that's really accurate to call it that. So, you know, Europe had 2 centuries to recover from the worst of things. And cities had revived. In the countryside, the population densities had begun to sort of outstrip the ability of the land to support them, which we know because we see human settlements spreading out into forest regions, which are actually fairly economically valuable on their own, but people needed food, so they started colonizing there. And so you had a large number of people living together in these cramped urban environments, some of them sort of living on the edge of starvation. And then we get this sort of famous set piece where a Mongol army was attacking a bunch of cities in the Crimean Peninsula that were held by Genoese merchants. And the Mongols they weren't doing too well, so they started, a plague broke out amongst their army. And so they started flinging the bodies of their comrades over the walls using these big counterweight trebuchets that they had. And the illness took hold in the cities. The Genoese merchants got on their ships and ran away. Yeah. And took the plague with them as they went. It is probable that the plague came into Europe from several points, but that's less fun to talk about. this set piece is way more dramatic, but historically speaking, it probably came in at a couple different points.
Yeah, that's one of those examples that we talk about as like some of the first instances of biological warfare.
Yes, exactly, definitely. So then once that happened, it spread out all along the trade routes. Italy, where these Genoese were going back to, was the center of a huge European spanning, a continent, you know, a landmass spanning trade network. And so it spread out all along these trade routes. Which brings us sort of to northern France. Starting in 1333, the empires of England and France were locked in what we would come to call the Hundred Years' War. Much of what we know about army camp life actually comes from this war and from the Crusades, both of which were sort of extremely well documented for whatever reason. So to finish up our look at army camp life, let's discuss the other kind of refuse that we'd been talking about in the camps of the Hundred Years' War. food waste, litter, animal droppings, everything that we would now classify as trash. They didn't have plastic wrappings or anything like that. But, you know, organic waste, things like that. In the cities, there was very little attempt made to collect and dispose of this kind of refuse. Mostly it was just sort of thrown out into the street where it collected in the gutters and then was hopefully washed down into rivers. And every couple of years, it would become clear that this wasn't really working, and they'd make some effort to change things, and then things would go back to the way they were.
Pigs.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Some cities had dedicated trash dumps, and so this is sort of the two options in the Middle Ages for how you deal with trash. You hope it washes away, or you create an open-air trash dump. Army camps probably did not function any better than the cities that in their societies. In most cases, trash was probably just tossed over the shoulder. Particularly conscious leaders of well-organized armies might have arranged dumps if possible. But again, like the latrines, that would only be happening if you were in one place for a really long time. So in other case, the rubbish would not be disposed of in any kind of covered sanitary landfill. Where it would be buried or something like that, it would just be open to the air. In the camp itself, we mentioned the army's carrying supplies of food in terms of the livestock before, which, of course, would be bitten by fleas. But we also should talk about food wasn't, you know, exactly being stored in cryo-sealed plastic sleeves or, you know, even some sort of tamper-proof metal or ceramic storage vessel. Bags would be made out of animal skins or flax fabric that had holes in it, and it would be used to store and haul grain and other dried foods like that. Dried and cured meats would be sort of just hung or stacked, and vegetables would just sort of be piled up in carts if they were available. The carts would probably be covered to keep off rain, but really what we're talking about is food just sort of sitting there out exposed to the elements. Raven, what kind of creatures might this attract?
What wouldn't it attract? Yeah. So, I mean, of course, we're dealing with things like roaches, but there's also, you know, for our purposes, the rats would be probably the biggest problem. You know, they're fairly big, and they would like consume a lot of it, and then they're also contaminating it with you know, their feces and urine. It's their food supply would not have been very good. Yeah, I think it's like so what impact.
Yeah. My daughter is joining us, just so everyone knows. But so the question is, you know, what impact did all this this stuff with the rats and the fleas and the plague that was spreading around Europe, what impact did that have on the Hundred Years' War? Well, let me put it like this. In 1347, the English won the famous Battle of Crecy. In 1348, the plague hit Paris and ravaged England within a short time period thereafter. So, given this lead-in, what do you think happened in 1355?
They put aside their differences and they focused on rebuilding their society and scientific pursuits.
Yes. No. Oh, that would be nice, but instead.
If only.
Instead, the English lost a massive chevauchée that toured almost the entirety of France and ended in the Battle of Poitiers. In fact, the war kept going, despite repeated visitations of the plague, until 1453. So, as we covered it's probably not that the brown rats were replaced by the black rats. We're most likely talking about a decline of plague over time as resistance grew among human, rat, and flea populations. But, you know, plague essentially, despite or perhaps because of the lack of interest in it shown by the armies of France and England, continued to be a problem right up until the 1700s. And, even then, the plague remained a major threat, even to advanced societies until the advent of antibiotics, and, you know, it's still around today.
Oh, yeah, there's people that die of it every year, even here in the United States. So yeah. But now it's more of an issue of oftentimes we don't recognize it for what it is until it's already done so much damage that it kills the person. It's a problem because it's so rare. Doctors don't know what they're looking at. You know, the last thing that they're thinking is, oh my gosh, this guy has the bubonic plague. it's kind of an interesting reverse issue.
Yeah, definitely.
So, like I mentioned at the top of the show, these are real illnesses. Modern science and public health efforts have done a lot to help us with these conditions, but they still kill people. We only have eradicated one disease. That's it. And that's smallpox. And we're on the verge of eradicating guinea worms. But even then, you know, in entire human history, we've only eradicated two diseases. So anything, you know, all of the stuff that we've been talking about, these are still serious issues for, you know, populations around the world. They are not that far away. And so by learning about these historical cases, we not only understand what our ancestors went through, but it also helps us connect with what's happening with people around the world today. It makes us aware that they can strike anyone, regardless of their country. It makes me very thankful for the work of doctors, scholars, other health workers that have put their lives' work into this to get us to the point that we're at now. And seeing how far we've come since the early modern period until today, it gives me a lot of hope for the future.
Yeah, from my perspective, historical cases can help us better understand what tools we can use as a society to prevent outbreaks in the future, which is something very relevant to me in my day job, as I mentioned before. And it just generally helps expand on the themes and interesting points from history.
So as a recap, today we talked about the scientific techniques that are used to determine which diseases people suffered from in the past. Vitamin deficiencies like scurvy and night blindness causing the breakdown of soldiers' bodies from a protein level.
And this is what happened to the armies outside of Diomede during the Fifth Crusade.
Typhus, the louse-borne disease hidden in clothing and blankets.
Which is what happened to the armies outside of Baza during the last stage of the Reconquista.
Dysentery, the intestinal condition that is made worse by a reduced immune system and in turn made vitamin deficiencies even worse.
And, you know, not to mention the camp conditions in medieval armies, and that's what happened during the Eighth Crusade outside of Tunis.
Malaria's destruction of the victim's blood and the mosquitoes that transmit it.
Yeah, and we talked about how King Pepin's army in Italy outside of Venice was probably, in all likelihood, destroyed by an outbreak of malaria, given that they were camped in a swamp.
Right, and also the insidious ways that the plague is spread by starving fleas.
And, of course, that's the illness that failed to end the Hundred Years' War.
So thank you for having me. So I'm Raven from the Tiny Vampires podcast, a podcast about disease, science, and blood-sucking insects. You can find me at tinyvampires.com and on Twitter at tinyvampirespod.
It was great talking to you today, Raven. This was a lot of fun. I'm Benjamin Jacobs of the Wittenberg to Westphalia podcast, which is the story of how Europe got modern. You can find me online at Wittenberg to Westphalia podcast at Weebly.com, and we have a nice Facebook page, and I'm on Twitter at W2W podcast, W2W podcast. So that's my Twitter handle. And thanks everybody for listening.
Yeah, thanks. Bye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.